And I am summarizing now because I'm running out of time. But I think that you want to see this article by VIPS. And if you pull up intelligence and VIPS on the web, then you will find that. And getting down to the details, the Russians, they write, were the ideal culprit. And after WikiLeaks editor Julian Assange announced on June 12, 2016, we have emails related to Hillary Clinton, which are pending publication. Her campaign had more than a month before the convention to insert its own, quote, forensic facts, end quote, and prime the media pump to put the blame on, quote, Russian meddling, end quote. And there's also an article by Mike Whitney in Counterpunch that points out a man named Craig Murray should be interviewed about all of this. And he says he met the person who took the emails from the DNC in a wooded area in Washington, D.C. last year. In other words, Murray can settle this matter once and for all and put an end to this year-long witch hunt that has consumed the media in Capitol Hill. This is not a pro-Trump broadcast, by the way. But neither is it a pro-Hillary Clinton broadcast. And so I want you to know the truth. So look to Counterpunch, look to VIPS, find the truth. This Russia story is complete bunkum. And now I'm joined by Per Fogring, who's coming in the room, and I would ask the engineer to run a bit of music and give us a bit of setup time, and we'll get going with that. Thirty-one on KBOO Portland, and I'm glad to say that Per Fogring is here in the studio.
Here I am. Well, good morning.
Good morning.
What a lovely, smoggy, smoky day.
Wow. it's something to see. I mean, just that weird color. I've seen it before, but it's disturbing. You know?
Mm-hmm.
For me, when I smell that air, too, it just automatically makes me anxious. I have to bring myself down continually. I think there's something chemical going on.
Something burning somewhere, like, you know.
Some part of my body is saying, run, there's a fire.
Somehow I think of a huge pile of vacuum cleaner bags all smoldering or something.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I see it as a sort of hint about global warming. I mean, we are not, it's been many, many decades, but the West Hills have caught fire in Portland before. We're not immune.
Mm-hmm.
So it's time to take those warnings seriously. But you're here to talk about
a little story about Newport, Rhode Island. You know, Newport, of course, is famous for being a sort of the home and playground of the super rich. And this actually started way back in the early 1800s when some of the first mansions were built by southern plantation owners who used to go to Newport in the summertime. It was too hot in the south. So they'd leave somebody else in charge of their slaves and spend the summers in Newport. And there was one fellow who built one of the big mansions called King's Coat, and it was built by a fellow named George Noble Jones. And he lived there and spent his summers there for several years. Then when the Civil War broke out, he left town. And it was the mansion was sold to William Henry King, who was a Newport China trader. Well, the China trade had to do with opium.
Yeah, talk about that for a minute. I mean, most people don't realize that a great deal of the wealth of the inheritance class in the United States now can be traced back to heroin dealers, well, not heroin, but opium dealers.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And the deal was, stop me if I get this wrong. I'm summarizing. The deal was that the opium was produced wherever it was produced, and it was put into ship holds with you know, baseball-sized balls of opium, which was then shipped and held off the coast of China and then sold to Chinese who were intentionally introduced to and addicted to, just like any pusher does, you know, mm-hmm. first dose is free, introduced to the stuff so that they could work harder and longer and make more money. This, you know, meth works this way too. And it's like you've got so much work to do. It's so hard. Have a snort of this. Oh my God, you're Superman now and you can make all this money and do two jobs and do three jobs. And whoops, it turns out that your health is in the toilet, but it's so profitable and you can't stop because it's so addictive. And so this made the equivalent of what today would be millions, many hundreds of millions of dollars. And this is, and it was just called under that euphemism, the China trade, but we're talking dope dealers.
That's right.
The founders of American wealth.
Some of our finest families. Few years back, I interviewed an author. His name is James Bradley. He wrote a book called The China Mirage. Very good book. I really recommend it. And he goes into the opium trade. Had to do a tea from India. Got sent to basically the West was forcing China to accept the opium as part of this trade combination they had. And some of the Delano family, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, his grandfather was one of these drug dealers, and some of Newport's finest families were involved in trade.
Now, tell me the name of that book again, China what?
The China Mirage.
Mirage, okay.
By James Bradley. Really good book. And I think the Vanderbilts were involved in that, too. Anyway, after the Civil War, you know, Mrs. Astor's famous 400 richest people kind of took over Newport, and they built all these lovely mansions along Bellevue Avenue and out on the ocean. And you also had the people who worked for the rich, including some of my relatives. My uncle, Ole Danielson, was
Ole, really?
Yes, he was the skipper of a racing yacht. A rich man's racing yacht. He didn't own the boat. He just sailed it on these Newport to Bermuda races that they had every 2 years.
I'm just charmed by that. Pyrfogering's Uncle Ole.
Uncle Ole, that's okay. Right. Ole Danielson. And he was my mother's brother. And he died in a fire on the yacht right around the time I was born, which is many years ago. And so his wife, Ruth, she was the caretaker for some of these mansions, because these people, they came there in the summertime and they were gone a lot of the rest of the year. So she had the keys to all these mansions, and she'd kind of go in there and check them out. I remember one time she took myself and sister and we visited one of the mansions, and it was huge, and all the furniture was covered with sheets and everything like that. So that was Aunt Ruth's job. And then after Uncle Ole died, she remarried a guy named Bert, who was his business was putting together these big tents and awnings for garden parties, things like that. So he had a whole lot of people who worked for the rich. But then in the middle of all this was a fellow named Timmy the Woodhooker. Timothy Sullivan was his name, and he was a junk dealer. And he had this ratty, run-down house right on Bellevue Avenue. The front yard was long grass and full of wood scraps. That's where you get the name Woodhooker from. And toilet seats and bathtubs and all sorts of junk. And his next-door neighbor, Mrs. Van Rensselaer, Mrs. Peyton Van Rensselaer, tried for years to get rid of this guy. She went around the neighborhood with petitions, and then to their credit, a lot of the rich folks refused to sign it. They thought Timmy had a right to be there. Is, you know, your own home is your castle, no matter how run down and squalid it may look like. And then another time, the house caught fire, and these are stories I heard from my Aunt Ruth. They never got in the papers or anything. A Swedish woman, neighbor, called the fire department, and they came and put the fire out. And Mrs. Van Rensselaer was hugely annoyed at the Swedish lady. She said she should have let the house burn down. And then they try to get Timmy on a vagrancy charge. And so they brought him to court. And
How does that work? How do you get a vagrancy charge for someone who lives in a residence?
Well, you have no means
town?
Of support. I mean, here we... Every day, Timmy would take this cart, and he'd go to a different part of town. He'd be right ahead of the garbage collectors. So he'd be wheeling his cart, and he'd pick stuff out of the trash cans and take them back to his... rundown house on Bellevue Avenue. And Mrs. Van Rensselaer, I guess, was accusing him of not having any means of support. So the judge told Timmy to bring in his tax records from the previous year. So he did. It turned out he made $50,000 that year. And this is when, back in the 40s, when money was worth a lot more. And so he made a good living just selling junk. And my cousin said he used to go by the house a lot, and there'd be cars parked from all over, license plates from all over the country, parked in front of Timmy's house, people out there buying junk.
So that's funny. They thought they'd bust him for being poor, basically, and it turns out he wasn't poor. But, you know, things just have not changed. I mean, in 96, I went to Cuba, and I used KBOO to tell people I'm going to Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
And I collected enough and went there and did a program on it and all this sort of thing. But I was really loud about going to Cuba. You know, hello, let's check out socialism. And when I got back, I got a notice from the state of Oregon that said that, I mean, it's the same thing, basically. It said, we're just going to assume that you made X amount of money, which was vastly in excess of what I actually did. I just cleaned apartments and I would make $400 a month, just about.
You didn't sell cigars on your way
back? plus whatever I got, you know, I knew all the free food sources, food not bombs and all that sort of thing. And that's how I ate. And they were just busting me for being a loud and uppity poor person. And it just, mm-hmm. you know, and of course, every homeless person here knows exactly what that attitude is about.
Well, anyway, they could never bust Timmy for vagrancy because he was not super rich, but he made a tidy living. And he lived in this house with his sister, Julia, and she never came out of the house. She just stayed in the house all the time. And one year, Timmy took the state civil service test, and he scored third highest in the state of Rhode Island. And they offered him some kind of nice government job. But he turned it down. He said the only reason he took that test was he wanted to show people that he wasn't stupid. He wasn't crazy. And so this went on for years and years. One year he wanted to, his house is really kind of falling down. And he asked if he could kind of build a new house. And so the city, they finally thought they had him. They refused his request. He said, well, you have to allow me to make repairs on the old one then.
Well, it seems kind of counterproductive. If the whole problem was that his place looked trashy and he wants to build a new place, well, that'll solve the problem, right? But no.
Well, what he did was, on the guise of making repairs, he kind of built a new house within the old one and then took down the walls of the old one. Well, after a while, the new house became pretty run down also. And so one year, back in the 50s, when I was at college, I drove down to Newport and I found the house. And I was out there kind of in the front yard, kind of inspecting his stuff he had for sale. And he came out of the house. He's kind of this sort of short, thin little fellow. He's kind of sort of like your stereotypical Irish guy, you know, kind of sort of skinny fellow with a big mop of dark hair. And he came out of the house, and he had a dog with him. And he had a rolled-up newspaper in his hand. So anyway, we said hello, and we were talking. And every now and then, the dog would growl. And he'd whack it across the nose with his rolled-up newspaper. And so I was looking for—I didn't know if I didn't really want to buy any toilet seats or anything. But finally I saw this crock, a sort of ceramic crock that kind of used for making beer and stuff like that. And so I asked him how much that was, and he gave me some price, which is pretty outrageous. And the crock had this little emblem on it, and the number five. And he said, "You see that number five there?" And I said, "Yeah." I says, "Well, that refers to that crock was at the coronation of King George V."
That's a crock, all right.
My thought was that actually it was a 5-gallon crock.
Yeah.
So that was Timmy. I got to meet him, and he was he sort of had a big following in the town of Newport. And finally, he did pass away, and his sister Julia a few years later. And when she died, her will stated that, I'm not sure exactly who she gave the house to, but stipulated that the house had to be kept in the condition in which it existed at the time, which is very run down.
Oh.
Well, the city fought that, and they finally won out in court. And I believe around 1970, they finally were able to, the house was attached to a neighboring estate, and it was finally torn down. So Timmy the Woodhooker's house is no longer there. It's sort of part of this estate and been managed with a manicured lawn and everything. But it's really something to go to Newport and see among all these huge mansions with great big lawns and gardens and everything. Here is this really run-down little house.
The extreme wealth of the owning class is really kind of hard to wrap your mm-hmm. head around. You hear about various things that they own. And I've never been into, maybe I should go into the Pittock Mansion here in, Monster Mansion here in Portland. But a friend of mine is an heir to the Otis elevator fortune. And so I have a story that's passed on secondhand from his friend. He went to visit, this is before he became the heir proper. He now lives in Santa Monica. But he's been in the news for a couple of quasi-political acts. But my friend tells me that he went into this mansion, and it's in somewhere in the area that you're describing, and the Otis family mansions on the East Coast. And they went and met the servants, the cooks, and had a good time and hung out in one end of the mansion and decided they would go. And it's, as you describe, a vast place, very nearly unoccupied with sheets over the furniture and beds. And they decided they'd go to the other end of the mansion. And he said they walked and walked and walked and walked and walked and walked and got to another mm-hmm. end of a mansion. And they found an entirely different set of servants and cooks who, like the first set, had nothing to do for years and were glad to see the two travelers show up so that they could cook them something.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this wealth just sitting there for no reason, not taxed away, just reserved to be given to heirs. And that's what the most recent figure I've seen for the super rich in the United States is that 70% of them have inherited the wealth, and that is the kind of wealth that the super rich inherit.
Well, these folks in Newport, these mansions, some of them were called cottages because they were summer homes. A lot of these people lived in New York most of the time, or Europe, or they traveled around a lot, you know, hitting all the high spots around the world. And so these mansions were sort of there for the summer social season. And some of them, they had big drawing rooms and ballrooms and everything, and very little in the way of bedrooms because the people there didn't really live there very long. They just used these mansions during the social season. And it's, I remember a mansion that was out on Long Island where I grew up. In Roslyn, New York. It was called the Mackey Mansion. And I remember when I was a kid, sometimes we'd hike over to Roslyn and go up the hill. And it was on this hilltop. And from it, on a clear day, you could see the skyline of Manhattan. Well, the Mackey Mansion was owned by some very rich family. I think it was a family that Irving Berlin married into later on. And for some reason, they let this mansion go to ruin. So us kids, we'd be able to get into the house and wander around these big, huge rooms with broken windows and plaster and dirt all over the floor. There was a grand stairway and there's an elevator shaft and huge rooms. And for some reason, I don't know why, but they just let it decay. And finally, I think it was torn down and turned into some kind of a housing development or something like that. But there it was, just sitting there for years and years and years, you know.
Yeah, there's no end to the excess. I mean, probably mm-hmm. the people who left it there had some other mansion which was more suited to them, and so they just could afford to forget about that one. It reminds me of going to cemeteries for the rich in Buenos Aires and also in Havana, where there are literally cities of mansion-like tombs, some of which actually have air conditioning and elevators. The streets are nicely paved and have little street signs. It's getting a bit tawdry in Havana. But not so in Recoleta Cemetery in Buenos Aires, where Evita is buried, and Evita Perón, and many, many rich people. And the statuary is just astonishing in places. The marble facades, I mean, I'm telling you, for being dead, this is high living.
Well, I think in Egypt there's a city of the dead someplace.
Karnak, I guess.
Yeah, I remember hearing about it or something like that.
What do you bet I'm wrong? I just pulled that out of my head. I haven't thought of that word for a long time.
They had
50,000 people laughing at me right now. I don't know. Maybe Karnak.
These tombs were like little mansions, little miniature mansions. And supposedly the spirits of the dead lived in them or something, you know. Of course, who knows? The grave robbers might be there poking around, picking up stuff. Maybe they can sell it to Timmy the Woodhucker or something.
Yeah. Kind of hard to be vigilant on all your stuff when you're stone dead. Well, that makes me kind of want to talk about distribution of wealth, if you're up for that.
Sure.
Shall we?
We're very exceptional in that regard, I think.
Yeah. Well, this is supposed to be the worst era ever in terms of distribution of wealth. I see maldistribution. I see the excess riches of one on one end as the direct cause of the extreme poverty on the other end. When I think that the aggregation of wealth in the United States is vastly greater than it ever has been, mm-hmm. and that it is so incredibly maldistributed that we have people living in the streets, it makes me want to again define capitalism for people who don't seem to understand what capitalism actually is, because most people, forgive me for repeating myself on this, I think this is one of those things that has to be repeated. Most people mix up capitalism with economic activity, which it is not. Economic activity.
Free enterprise.
Free enterprise is free enterprise. Economic activity is economic activity. Capitalism is someone coming to you and saying, because I have the money, even if I just borrowed it, inherited it, or whatever. Most often just borrowed it, I get to be a boss. I get to be a person who tells you what work to do, when to do the work.
I'm renting your time.
You become a peon, a thing that is related to a slave to me, especially in large groups where you have no choice economically but to work with the boss or a boss. I can tell you what to wear, how to act, what to say, everything, mm-hmm. and I can make you go away and pay you what I feel like, and I can pay you nothing when I'm done with you. I can use you up and I can throw you away, and I will, and that's how capitalism works. It's capitalism. It's like all of these privileges go to the person who has the capital, the money up front, and all of these penalties and all this loss of agency and loss of economic power go to the other class, the people who are the victims of capitalism, the employees. So you have the boss, the employees. That's capitalism. When I say capitalism has failed, that's what I'm talking about. I'm not mm-hmm. talking about technological wonders and sales processes and salesmen and you mowing lawns for money. That is not capitalism.
Well, the stock market, I think yesterday hit a a new high, a record high of 22,000 or something. And this is taken as a sign that the economy is doing very well, thank you. But this is not really true, because what's pushing up the stock market, besides all the easy money floating around, is the that corporate profits are very high. Well, when corporate profits are very high, that does not automatically mean that workers' wages are high. They're not. Workers' wages have been basically pretty steady, pretty flat since the 1970s.
They're abominable. I mean, not only are the wages low, but the access to full-time work is so low that people mm-hmm. cannot make sufficient.
Even though productivity has gone up a lot. Well, productivity translates into profits. It means the working class has gotten very, very little of that productivity, even though they're the ones who are producing. And most of it has gone into profits. So that's what pushes up the stock market. Meanwhile, the economy is really going to the dogs. I've never seen anything like the number of homeless people. You know, if somebody told me 20 years ago that in this year we would see tents all over the city, sidewalks and parks and everything, you know, I wouldn't believe them, but here they are, you know.
And yet we could kind of predict it, and some people kind of did mm-hmm. When Reagan came into office, because the idea with Reaganism was like, oh, never mind all this reform.
Mm-hmm.
Never mind trying to compete with the idea of communism through the Soviet Union. That was a thing that was much stronger under Eisenhower, who would make statements about prosperity and distribution of wealth pretty directly in competition with the Soviets, saying we're going to prove that capitalism is better because it will give more money to more people. And it was that pressure of communism, the idea that on the other side of the globe, there were people who were actually going to distribute whatever little wealth they had, and that might be a better system. It scared the crap out of the government and put a kink in corporate plans to aggregate as much money as they now do. And when Reagan came in, as you know, it was like, oh, never mind all that. We're just going to defeat the commies by threatening them with nuclear weapons and economically bankrupting them. And that pretty much worked in terms of destroying that empire, in terms of destroying the Soviet Union. So there's no need to pretend that anymore that capitalism is going to make you wealthy. Instead, the technique is simply to blame each worker for their own failings and say, well, you're poor because you haven't got it together, because you're not a genius, because mm-hmm. you haven't worked hard enough, because you made bad choices, because you don't have the right degree, whatever, just excuses. And then the distribution of wealth has gotten worse and worse and worse since 1980. And so, of course, there are people in tents on the sidewalks because, you know, after a while, after generations of this now, at first, you know, when there weren't enough jobs to go around and they didn't quite pay enough, you know, the way it was in the 80s, well, you could go live with your folks, okay? Mm-hmm. But now the people, the folks that you would go to live with have been bankrupted by Reaganism for 37 years. Mm-hmm. So there isn't a home to go to, so you live in the streets.
Well, if you take a longer view, America, when we conquered the so-called New World, you know, lived on slavery and stealing land from the Indians, we stole a huge amount of resources.
When you say we mean white people.
Well, the European settlers, yeah. You know.
Using whiteness as the distinction.
And so a huge amount of oil. At one time, you know, we went through, we kind of burned through our oil, and the huge amount of resources that we grabbed, we have largely squandered. The oil is running out. We are not going to sell oil to the rest of the world. We are still an oil importer, and the oil is being taken out of the market for climate reasons, and also because it's getting lower quality oil all the time. So we ran through this sort of inheritance, or whatever you want to call it, and now we're sort of stuck.
I have to agree. I mean, we've also squandered the population. We have mm-hmm. half the population that can't put together $4,000 for an emergency, half the population mm-hmm. that can't afford better education, that looks for education only as a utility and not as a public good. I could go on and on, but we're out of time.
We're out of time.
Per, thanks so much
for joining me. I think America's out of time, too, as a matter of fact.
I think you're right. I'm really looking forward to you coming back 2 weeks from now with Fight the Empire.
Okay. It'll be fun being here.
Will be. Until then, we'll be broadcasting via KBOO.FM to all the ships at sea.
Hey, good morning. It is KBOO Portland. A minute now before 10 o'clock on your Thursday. At 10:15, we've got Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11 today, it's Between the Covers. Today, talking to author Julie Israel about her new book, Juniper Lemon's Happiness Index, a story of grief, friendship, and secrets. And then at 11:30, it's Black Book Talk. Today, rebroadcasting its interview with Portland poet, actor, vocalist, and author Mario DePriest about his book, The Power of a Rose, what he calls an attempt to interject a calming breeze of romantic hope into a world of turbulence. That is all coming up on your busy Thursday, right after Air Cascadia, with headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre, right after this.
KBOO hosts a monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater called KBOO at the Clinton. This month we'll screen the film Keep the Hives Alive on Thursday, August 10th at 7 p.m. Bees and other pollinators are declining at an alarming rate. An overwhelming number of scientific studies link these population declines to pesticide use. Keep the Hives Alive is a documentary film that shows the use of toxic pesticides are having far-reaching impacts on a wide range of environments, including beehives. Again, that's a film screening at the documentary Keep the Hives Alive, Thursday, August 10th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at the KBOO.FM on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Thursday, August 3rd,